common mode. If I feed it a thoroughly balanced voltage so that the right-hand signal is always identical but opposite in polarity from the left-hand wire signal, that's called differential mode of feeding that wire. Now, when you start including the length of wire and what goes on inside of a directional coupler, and what you're feeling is the so-called common mode for that structure, we're getting beyond the usual definition of transmission line and methods of feeding. Bell has been sliding from differential mode to repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel. Bell has been sliding from differential mode to common mode on his full wave 80 meter loop antenna and seeing all kinds of advantages in polarization characteristics and angle of arrival characteristics, in other words, steering the electronic beam. So he is sliding from common mode, or correction, from differential mode to common mode when he does that. I know that this is not the whole answer to it, but I think by the usual definitions of the terms, I think I've defined differential and common mode. Common mode on twin lead radiates like crazy. Differential mode radiates not at all. If the distance between the two wires is an extremely small fraction of a wavelength. If the distance between the two wires is 0.01 wavelength, then when you stand off in any direction you can imagine, the amount of signal you're getting from the right-hand wire and the amount of signal you're getting from the left-hand wire are absolutely identical, exactly 180 degrees out of phase, you see nothing. You call that a shielded structure. So as long as it's thoroughly balanced, and you'd be amazed how many kinds of HDMI cables, among other things, that are using dual differential signaling, and the magic that that creates in shielding between signal A and signal B is really magic at times. What goes on inside of Cat5 cable uses this phenomenon very effectively, even though it's an extremely inexpensive looking cable when you take it in cross section. KC2 QIQ, KQRIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I guess the interesting thing, though, is that it's a little bit confusing to me still, vocabulary-wise, is when you're looking at, I guess, the balance line, okay, and what you define, definitely the balance line would be, in that case, the differential feeder. But now, in the, let's say, the unbalanced configuration, I guess the same rule applies as well?
Reword the question. I guess the same rule applies also, and I was a little unclear on what preceded that. Give it to me again, Glenn. Go ahead.
Well, I guess when we talk about the lateral line, we're usually talking about it being fed as a balanced line, like, you know, with a balun on one end and, you know, a tuner on the other end and things of that nature. So we're generally talking about the lateral line being a balanced structure. But now coax is typically in an unbalanced structure. Now, is that also considered, I guess that's still, I'm saying it still applies there too. It's in other words, because of the way that it's fed is what determines whether it's still differential mode.
A coax cable properly fed is definitely differential mode, is extremely well shielded for two reasons. One, the signal flowing up the semiconductor, let's call it current. The current flowing up the semiconductor and the total amount of current flowing down the outer conductor are absolutely equal to each other. So it has that kind of natural shielding. Beyond that, because the outer conductor is thoroughly wrapped around the semiconductor, it has a second kind of shielding. So the cable itself is an extremely well-shielded structure when properly used. There's a big catch. If you just take the end of that coax cable and simply connect the semiconductor to the right-hand side of your dipole and the shield to the left-hand side of the dipole, although the antenna is a balanced structure, because the balanced structure tries to act like two impedances to ground, even though you may be operating your dipole in orbit around the planet and you're 160 miles up above Earth, still that dipole electronically acts like it has a certain impedance from the right-hand side to ground. Now the word ground takes on some peculiar meaning when you're in space. It might be the whole damn space shuttle that's nearby, but you know what I mean. But the antenna has a certain amount of impedance from the right-hand side of the dipole to what you call ground, and the left-hand side of the dipole to what you call ground. So therefore, when you're feeding that dipole with your coax cable and you're really having a dipole near Earth, that balancing characteristic is such that at one instant of time, there is plus 1 volt on the right-hand side of the dipole and minus 1 volt on the left-hand side of the dipole. Since the left-hand side of the dipole is connected to the shield, you now launched minus 1 volt on the outside conductor of the shield. The dipole did that for you. Up until the signal flowing down the center of the coax cable came up to your balun and or dipole, it was a thoroughly symmetric shielded structure, confined signal, not radiating. Once you go through a non-balun straight to the dipole itself having these two impedances to ground and the way it forces things to happen, you're now launching a signal back down the outside of the coax cable. If this was the best of all worlds, then the KC2QIQ dipole, directly fed with coax cable, would be launching a 2-volt signal on the right-hand side of the dipole connected to the semiconductor, and a 0-volt signal on the left-hand side of the dipole that's connected to the shield. If this is the best of all worlds, your dipole would do that, and now you would have no signal flowing down the outside. Mother Nature won't let you get away with that. She is forcing that dipole to have a certain kind of balance characteristic because each half of the dipole truly has another impedance to the rest of the universe that we really talk about. But it's really there. It's really there, and as such, it will now launch a signal back down the outside of the coax cable if you didn't use a balun. Once you use that balun, there's a kind of a transformer-like structure where the signal from your coax cable is going into the primary, and now a thoroughly floating secondary wire on the output of that transformer is connected to the two halves of your dipole. Now you're feeding the dipole in a thoroughly symmetric manner from a thoroughly symmetric structure called balun, and now you have no ability to launch signals back down the outside of the coax. The antenna is not going to go up in smoke if you don't use a balun, but you're going to have hot cable in many cases. You're going to have RF in the shack in many cases if you don't use that balun when you connect to a dipole. I wonder if that makes some sense, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Oh, it sure does, Dick. And as it absolutely, you know, that's why I've been telling people 3 years I've been putting up, you know, dipole antennas. Try to get balun always at the, you know, right at the antenna itself. And the reasoning there is exactly for the reason that you just mentioned, you know, because you have the unbalanced feed line, and if you just connect directly to the antenna, you're going to wind up with all kinds of a possible radiating situation of the coax, which could be nasty, and you can break that up easily with a balun. As I said, it's just always interesting with, you know, coming from my background, talking about filter networks and other things where, you know, we use one terminology for common mode and differential, and then again with feed lines, although it looks similar to common mode, it's really differential. But I just wanted to get that straight, and you explained it very, very well, Dick. So let me pass back to you, and I guess Mel has something else to say. So K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Thanks again, Dick.
I have a question for Mel.
Yeah, that balun that we're talking about, in some cases, can be really a poor man's balun. You take a 3, 4, or 5 turns of the coax cable near the antenna, tape them together. That constitutes an RF choke. Although the antenna itself is launching signal on the outside of the coax cable, it looks at that coil of wire as an RF choke, and the signal essentially doesn't flow any further. Mel is going to make some comments on all this, and Alan wants to add to what Mel's about to say. So Alan first, and then you pass it directly to Mel. KC2 RFN, K2LAW in the tech net.
KC2 RFN. Mel, you, Dick has said that you have your dipole set up for both differential and common mode. How did you hook those up? What's the difference between the two wiring?
This is K2KEY, Alan. It is not a dipole. It is a loop, a full-wave loop on 80 meters. And it's fed with open wire feeders. It's basically one wire, continuous. What it does is starts at the shack. It goes up to a insulator. It goes around 275 feet through a number of supports. Big rectangle. And it's a little bit of unbalanced as a rectangle. It's not a perfect square. or quote, somewhat lopsided because of certain situations, comes back to that insulator where the other, where the wire first went up, and then goes down, back down to the shack with homebrew threaded 600 ohm wires, fed to a Johnson kilowatt matchbox using link couplings, a little different type of design tuner, very popular back one time. It has balanced input to this tuner, no balance, you know, all involved anywhere in the system. It uses link coupling, and with RF amp meter, in either line, I can change the differential. You followed so far, Alan, over.
Yes, I do.
A lot of people, when looked at it, it says, I don't understand. You mean to tell me your higher SWR by swinging it through, in many cases, is an advantage to one particular way you're transmitting? Oh, yes. No doubt. Goes against everything they say. In fact, as people have said for years, oh, yeah, balanced wires, open wire feed is a good source of PVI. No way. Has nothing to do with it, except, let me give you one instance. Okay. Back in the days when 300 ohm wire was the popular way for television antennas to be fed to the TV set, I had a problem. It was a local problem. At times when the TV set was set on channel 11, there was a herringbone that was being generated. I finally ran that down because it was being blamed for this problem, which of course was not my fault. It was to another neighbor's television set that had one wire of the 300 ohm wire connected to the back of the set. One wire was off, disconnected. They didn't know from their picture, knowing whatever it was, good enough. But when that set was on channel 7, the other set got locally a herringbone on channel 11. Because it was now radiating the tuner, the local oscillator, the tuner with the harmonic relationship from channel 7 to channel 11 would cause that. But putting the wire back on took that condition away. So balanced wire does not radiate. Good example, Dick. Go ahead.
Now, at the awards dinner that Alan and I were at 2 weeks ago in Paramus, New Jersey, where the technical net got this award that Alan created the nomination for. The president of ARRL, who presented that award to me, told me that she and her husband had just put up a full-wave 80-meter loop antenna in their backyard in Blacksburg, Virginia. And I told her about the KEY experiment on differential versus common mode, and she and her husband started asking me, okay, what does that mean? How did he do that? I told him about the multiple S units of improvement in signal strength of reception and or transmission occurs when you use a loop antenna in that manner. And so eventually they're going to be, once they're finished with that installation of that antenna and are ready to feed it in a more elaborate manner to get all this benefit, I think they're going to be contacting you, Mel. So the president of the league wants to know what you've been doing, Mel. The president of the league and her husband, who's also a ham radio operator. I'll back to you for any comment on that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I know a number of the people at the league. Joel Howard is a friend of mine, and a couple others I know quite well. I've had many conversations with them, and sort of a little bit, you know, disclaimers here and there about, like you say, this has been batted around for such a long time that, well, you put up a dipole and you use open wire feeders, oh, you're going to have PVI problems and whatnot. But I have dispelled that very much in a number of demonstrations. And yeah, Kate Craig, he is a very nice person, had a one time a conversation briefly with her. And yeah, I guess it's, like you say, it's more than most amateurs have experienced. So I guess we'll just, you know, be able to explain it in detail to them if they want to pursue a tick over.
In that last transmission, Mel, you said some magic words that I want to run them by one more time. Of all the people who gave you flack, told you that the, hey, Mel, why are you building that antenna and why are you using open wireline? It's going to radiate. In other words, you were again being fed the misinformation by a high percentage of your fellow amateurs that open wireline, particularly if there's standing wave ratio at the antenna, that the open wireline will radiate. You were being directly told that, and you're probably being told, don't use open wireline for that loop antenna because of its radiation. Is that approximately true, Mel? Go ahead.
Since I've been a youngster, starting in ham radio, I used to hear all kinds of things that didn't make sense to me at the time. I did not have the right words to answer them, how come, why, or anything like that. But I heard this from way back. I'm going to go back, you know, to the beginning of time and I've got TBI problems. What kind of antenna? I'm using 300 ohm wire, you know, because like you say, it was so common. It was the cheapest way to buy feed line in those days. Oh, what coax? Pick it right up. Your feed line is doing it. And I said to myself, how could that be? How could this happen? And because, but then when I started to be able to read books and a lot of things, I was able to, well, I got 75 meters. I gave up. I don't get into those midnight arguments anymore with them, whatever they want to say. But it's such nonsense that is battered around, like you say. I don't know how these things get started, but I hear it. Still hear it constantly, Dick. Over.
Okay, one more question here, Mel. I'm trying to now approximately quantify the degree of this misinformation. You're a guy who does a hell of a lot more HF operating than I do. I'm primarily a VHF, SHF person. So if I go back in my logbook, I have to go back an awful long distance to find the place where I was last on 20 meters, we'll say. You're a guy who goes there periodically. Make a guess for me, Mel. If you did a survey today in the 21st century on, say, the 20-meter or the 80-meter band among respected HF operators, what's your guess as to the percentage of those HF operators who will tell you that open wireline, 600 ohm, 400 ohm, 300 ohm, open wireline, 450, any of the open wirelines operating in the situation of standing wave ratio will be a radiating structure? What's your guess as to the percentage of the amateurs you can contact today that will tell you that? Do you think at least half of them might say that? Over to you, Mel.
I'd say 80%, N2EO and the Mobios.
Fantastic. Let's see what Mel's got to say. Go ahead, Mel.
I think Rich may be even conservative, maybe more. I'd say if I lined up five guys on the frequency, guaranteed, maybe four out of five would definitely agree. Say that, oh, sure, that's been known for amateur radio since way back. That's one of the causes of that. We've had TBI problems back in the old days, and on and on and on and on. And another one, he'll tell you that if you put up a dipole and you use number 12 wire with insulation on it, that your signal will, degrade quite a bit. Why? Well, I say all you have to do, you may have to change the length of the wire, but I don't see why is the signal going to degrade because it's house wiring. No, you got to have hard-drawn wiring. And if you go from the hard-drawn wiring, if you use number 12, hard-drawn wiring, you'll want to improve yourself. Spend a little more money and buy number 10 hard draw wiring. And, I said, well, what kind of, you know, improvement? I say, oh, DB, you'll go from F9 to 10 over. I said, you'll pick up maybe 10 dB gain. Oh, definitely. This I've heard a dozen times, Dick. Over.
Wow. That degree of misinformation and cross-coupling and propagating of misinformation. That's just amazing. And here you get a guy who appears to be the smartest guy we know of when it comes to magnetics, among other kinds of measurement, Glenn, who has, with his own instrumentation, made the measurement. and it ain't true. I mean, the loftiest theories in the world are fairly useless if somebody doesn't somewhere along the line confirm it with real instrumentation and a real measurement in the real world. Mother Nature has got some nasty surprises for us, and not everything is made. This universe, assuming that there was an omnipresence who designed this universe, he did not design this universe to be easy to understand. If you think the problem is easy, you probably don't understand the problem. Nothing is simple when you get down to the nitty-gritty. And so this misinformation is just wild to me. And I've heard it so many times, I thought I was just unlucky. You guys are telling me it's 80 or 90%. Wow. And so I can see how it's an extremely popular opinion with nobody confirming it. And by the same token, I can find a zillion people who tell you that your transmission line better have the smallest number of connectors and adapters that's possible. That you better have one single piece of transmission line that comes out of the back of the transmitter, goes through the wall of the house, up the tower, and straight to the antenna with nothing in between. That every single type N connector has half a dB of loss. I heard that for darn many years. And occasionally you get a conservative guy who say, hey, it's only a quarter of a dB of loss per connector. And if you're going through an adapter at each junction, you're getting another quarter of dB of loss. Pure hogwash. Wild. But in order for the rubber insulation to be left on outside, on the household wire, 14 gauge, 12 gauge, 10 gauge, or whatever, you leave the rubber insulation on that wire. Or if you buy enameled wire and you leave the enamel on there and you make a dipole out of it, the RF energy goes through that insulation. It could be an outer layer of PVC pipe. It could be the outer layer of the rubber. It could be the outer layer of the varnishing of enameled wire. That RF just goes through the insulator. It may experience a tiny bit of capacitive loading, which means that the velocity of propagation along that wire, because of that capacitive loading, is a little bit slower. Just like your transmission line, RG8 cable with polyethylene has got a 66% or a 63% velocity factor. Just because the signal travels slower in the cable doesn't mean it's got loss. That's not where the loss is coming from. So, wild. We got to slowly correct all these pieces of misinformation because it's holding people back. There's one exception to this rule. Let me drop and tell you about it. The so-called K6YNB, Quaggy antenna, Quad Loop Yagi antenna. That's where Wayne Overbeck, K6YNB as he used to be known, I think he's now N6YNB or N6YB, he changed his call letters. He came up with this rather nice Yagi, good for California, where you've got a wooden boom and you make the driven element in a cubical quad manner, but all the other elements are built in a normal dipole manner. And I think there's versions of it where the reflector is a cubical quad reflector, the driven element is a cubical quad, and the rest of the directors are all normal dipole-like directors. Coat hanger wire all strung on a piece of wooden boom. And the wooden boom idea is great for the Mojave Desert of California, where everything's nice and dry. But the wet weather we have here on the East Coast, that's not the recommended material for a boom. That's another whole subject. But when you build that driven element, square loop antenna, out of the copper wire that Wayne recommends, works like a charm. Leave the rubber insulation on there, and the capacitive loading makes the driven element a slightly different frequency, and you end up with some vizwar of the antenna if you're not willing to readjust the size of the diameter, so to speak, of the driven element. And the guys in Europe were using a different wire that's metric size with a different size of rubber insulation that's popular over there, and they were getting different results, again, if they weren't willing to tune it. You'd be amazed how many people who will build a Yagi antenna, and somehow, even though they've made a change in the materials that they're using, they will still follow the dimensions of the original design to the nearest small fraction of a millimeter, to the nearest couple thousandths of an inch. They will follow the design, even though they've made changes in the materials, and then they'll scream and holler that the antenna doesn't tune the same way. They'll say it's a terrible design. Once you homebrew an antenna, even if you're using the exact same materials, let me drop. You may not be aware of it, but you've made minor changes. You didn't make the corners quite as square as he did. You didn't round off the tips of the dipole-like elements as much as he did. And that makes a difference on a Yagi. on VHF frequency. Whether or not you chamfered the tips or just left them square as the way you cut them with your hacksaw, so to speak. Or if you cut them with dikes, you get a different kind of shape at the tips. There are some very subtle things that start piling up with your particular method of construction. And if you're smart enough, you'll realize there's going to be some minor variation. And if you want the viswire to be super low, you've got to do a little bit of retuning of that driven element. And it's a very simple solution. But if you're not willing to do that, if you're saying, I follow the design to the nearest 3,000th of an inch, and it doesn't work the way the designer described it to me, and therefore it's a lousy design. You'd be amazed how many people will say things like that. And it's not justified. Okay. I kept poor Eric waiting long enough. KC2WIE. I hope you're still with us, Eric. K2LIW in the sec net.
Yes, Alan, I am, but I'm going to have to forego my question. I'm getting an EHF demand by my little pooch here that he wants to go out, so some other time then. Very interesting dialogue tonight regarding ham radio. Have a good night, you and all. KC2WIE, clear.
I haven't asked my question yet, Dick.
Eric, we're going to make you a deal. Your pooch is going to have to be walked for, I'm going to pick a number, 20 minutes. The segment goes on until midnight. Whenever you come back, announce the fact that you're back, and we're going to go back over to your question. Is that okay with you, Eric?
Dick, my question was purely, out of curiosity, not too much interest, but... when I get back, I'll check in with you. Thank you.
The one thing that this TechNet respects more than anything else is curiosity on anything with reference to physics or electronics, wireless in particular. We love curiosity. You're allowed to ask a question on any subject. We might tell you we haven't got the vaguest idea, but the price is right. Go ahead, Alan. KT2, my mind's going blank. You know who you are. Go ahead, Alan. KC2RIW. RCN.
Okay, KC2RF. The question I had was, I was talking with somebody on 17 meters today. It turns out he was only two towns over from me. And he was having some problems with his equipment. And he's not technically savvy at all. So he ran them by me. And I told him I would run it by you on the TechNet tonight. His setup is a TS-2000 going to a butterfly antenna beam, the HF-5B. He's having problems with high SWR. He's only able to tune in on 17 meters. Anything outside of that is a very hard time tuning in, and on 20 meters, he can't tune in at all anymore. Let me just drop.
By the way, was he ever able to tune in the past, and it's changed, or is it that way straight out of the box? Over to you, Alan.
Okay, I'm just about to get to that. Yes, 6 years ago, when he had the equipment installed, it was always a little touchy with SWR, always touchy. But it wasn't too bad. It started causing some TBI and interference on the cordless phone in his home and the radios in his daughter's room. He assumed it was a grounding issue. He's located in the attic, so he's about 25 feet off the ground. And so he ran a number 12 or number 14 wire down to a 3-foot rod that was hammered into the ground. And then he attached that wire to the different components of the shack using the shield braid of some runs of coax. So he used coax line as his braid. So he has it grounded, and then it takes care of the TVI problem, but he's radiating even more so into the radio and into his cordless phone. And as the years went by, the antenna's been up now for 6 years, the problem has steadily worsened to the point where he had to add an external tuner so that he could tune in all the bands except 17. It always seems to work fine on 17. But outside of that, it's impossible to tune on 20 meters now. so he's sort of stuck with a very narrow band. I spoke with Bob OSR today, and he said that the antenna that's being used really has a flaky SWR issue, so maybe that's part of it. But it was a problem that started out minor and has now become a major issue. So I asked him a bunch of questions, so if you need some information, I may have already asked it. But with those symptoms, where do you think he should go and look?
Yeah, I'm looking at the Venture Incorporated Butternut HF5B 5-band butterfly beam antenna, $525. I'm looking at it on a page right now, and I see a nice picture of this thing. The fact that it worked better at one time suggests that some mechanical electronic connection changed. In other words, if he had the ability to bring it down and give it a good, strong visual inspection, I think he's built up some oxide on where the coax braid is connecting to things, water got into the cable. In other words, a change along those lines is something. A good visual inspection is where I would begin. If he had the right kind of instrumentation, he could use a time domain reflectometer. And as bad as that sounds, there are a few amateur radio clubs that own one of these things. There's amateur versions of these where he could, if he wanted to, confirm that his transmission line... Let me drop. He wants to be sure that the transmission line hasn't done something funny. In other words, assuming he's got 75 feet of transmission line between the transmitter and the antenna, did that transmission line rub against the gutter of the house and you've cut through the braid, so to speak? A TDR would find that. So would a visual inspection. If he had to match two pieces of cable together with an adapter and water got in there or corrosion got in there. So a good visual inspection of everything starting from the connector itself that sits on the end of the transmission line in the shack that connects to his transmitter or to his antenna tuner. A good hard look at that antenna connector. Twist it with your hand and make sure it's got real good connection and the braid hasn't broken away. Walk your way along the transmission line to be sure that it and its adapters haven't sucked up water and bad contacts and rubbed against something. And the antenna itself, a visual inspection of all of its connections and maybe a cleanup of some of those. Open up the joints and scrape them with a knife and put them back together and spray them with Krylon. Where the antenna once worked, I think Mother Nature, weather, time, corrosion, and vibration did something to it. He'd be happy if he's back to his former operation. And once you've got the corrosion on connectors, you can very easily end up with the cable itself radiating. The cable goes by in close proximity to his daughter's room, therefore a stronger amount of signal on his frequency, even though he's got good filtering in his rig. A stronger amount of overload signal is getting into his daughter's radio and creating that grief. These are some of my guesses. So a good visual inspection first, and I think there's a 80% chance he's going to find it that way, Alan. KC2 RFN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Do you think that 25 feet of ground line that's going from his attic shack down to the 3-foot rod in the ground, could that perhaps be singing?
Okay. I should have addressed that one. To ground something through a short length makes some sense. 25 feet of ground line, it's not doing any RF grounding. People put in grounding for three reasons, and I know you've heard this, but I'm going to repeat it for some other people. There's three reasons you put in grounding. Number one is human safety. By having grounding of your equipment, if anything goes wrong, such that the chassis of your equipment gets the hot side of the 110-volt line touching it, and now the chassis of your equipment and the coax cable becomes hot, and somebody touching it and touching a grounding device, or touching it and standing on wet lawn, could potentially give himself an electrical shock. So you do grounding for that reason, particularly when you're running on portable power, like a motor generator set at a field day site. Grounding there is very important for human safety reasons. The second reason you put in grounding is for lightning protection reasons. You'd like the main mast of your antenna, if it's a Yagi-like thing with a mast coming out of it, you'd like that to be grounded with a ground rod, and their 25-foot long ground rod is perfectly good, as long as there aren't any sharp bends in it. You'd like the lightning to hit the mast and go down that grounding system and not go into your coax cable and damage the front end of your receiver. The third reason people do grounding is they believe it's going to make some improvement in radio frequency interference, television interference, whatever. In the majority of cases, it does not, particularly at HF and VHF frequencies where the length of that grounding system is quite often quite a significant number of wavelengths. If I've got a quarter wavelength of wire between the world's best burst ground and the thing that I want to ground, the laws of physics dictate that a transmission line does what's called impedance inverting. That piece of wire, even though it's not coax, it's a piece of wire that you're doing grounding with, it's open in air. Let me drop. It's hard to believe, but it really does have an impedance. And maybe that impedance is 271 ohms, but as a transmission line, it has 271 ohms of apparent impedance. And you've got the bottom end that's grounded. And every quarter wavelength of line, or an odd number of quarter wavelengths of line, does impedance inverting. No matter what my transmission line is, if I create a perfect short circuit at one end of it, a quarter wavelength away, I've got the world's best open circuit at that frequency. Is that a ground? No way in hell. So an odd number of quarter wavelengths of something that is grounded is a perfect non-ground. An even number of quarter wavelengths, half wave, one wave, and whatever, is a quasi-ground at that frequency. But the wire itself will be hot and radiating. So to ground something for RFI reasons almost never is successful, in my opinion. Over to you, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW.
K2KEY, I want to make a comment on this.
Go ahead, Mel.
Good you bring that up, because this is another one. I've been asked, and I forgot to bring this up again. Let's debunk another thing. That if you're putting up a vertical that says ground, driving a ground rod in next to the vertical does not give you the counterpoint, Dick Covert. I want to make, that's another thing that is a misnomer. That all you do, well, why lay down ground radio? All you do is, why not just put down a couple or one good ground rod over?
First of all, if you have the right kind of instrumentation, and you compared how good is the ground of that ground rod at your RF frequency compared to how good is the ground of your ground plane radial system of eight wires that are a quarter wavelength long, I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find there's a 100-to-1 difference in true impedance of the universe. That ground rod is reasonably inductive. And, I mean, Earth is moderately good as a conductor. If I sing a real good ground rod at the north end of my property and a real good ground rod at the south end of my property, and each of those ground rods have got salted materials around them, on a good day I might measure an impedance between those two ground rods, even though they're 100 feet apart, I might measure one or two ohms. At RF frequencies, I do that same measurement, I'm going to come up with a huge number of ohms, because it takes the whole length of an 8-foot long rod, every little inch of it connecting to that slightly conductive earth, to finally make good contact. RF-wise, along the length of that rod, it ain't a good ground. So first of all, the impedance of the ground rod at the base of your ground plane antenna, the impedance is terrible compared to what it should be. That's only one thing that's wrong. The second thing is that the radiator itself is putting out a strong local RF piece of energy. Particularly at the base of it, it's putting out a whole lot of magnetic field. That magnetic field is seeing the local Earth for quite a few feet around that antenna, quite a few tens of feet around that antenna. It looks at that as dummy load material. That dummy load material sucks up the RF and turns it into heat. By you laying down enough ground plane radial, you're creating a shield between the RF energy you want to radiate and that ground, which is an RF absorber to some degree, in the near field. In the far field, it's a pretty good reflector acting like a mirror, but in the near field, like you are with...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
In the near field, it's a... You've got to shield your signal from that end, from that ground. So a simple ground rod, even though a couple of the naive antenna manufacturers have said that in a pinch you can do that, yeah, you're on the air, but you might have 48% efficiency, so to speak. 52% of your energy is being coupled into the Earth, turned into heat, and never really radiated. So that ain't a good ground. Back to you, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2RFN, yeah, we jumped to antenna ground, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about grounding the shack and his 25 feet of wire running down through a rod in the ground. Yeah, so you're saying it definitely can sing, it will sing. So the question is, yeah, what do you do now? He does want it grounded because he believes that it helps with RFI. Certainly he said it helps with TVI, and of course for safety reasons. But he's 25 feet up off the ground. So what can he do? Can he use a strap of copper strap going down the 25 feet? Would that make a difference? Or is there some other alternative or mechanism he can utilize to get the radio ground and the safe electrical ground he's looking for?
The ground he's got is fulfilling the first two requirements, safety for human electrical shock potential and some lightning protection. But almost anybody standing any distance above Mother Earth, the second floor or higher in a building that is a non-metallic building with no local large metallic objects like water pipes and whatever, as long as you're above Mother Earth, no matter what you put down and you call it ground, almost nobody with knowledge, in my opinion, is going to call that an RF ground. It is not going to get an RF ground. And even if you could get an RF ground, only in rare circumstances would that make any difference to television interference. If you're getting television interference because you've got a lot of RF signal flowing down the outside of your coax cable because you didn't use a ballon at the antenna or because there's some other lack a poor connection at the antenna itself. I mean, an open UHF connector that's not properly tightened at the antenna will launch a lot of signal down the outside of the coax cable. And that RF energy now in the shack and along that cable being radiated, coming near other structures that are susceptible, like the Rudder's radio, a grounding rod and a grounding strap is not going to correct that, no matter how wide you make that strap. Yes, if you made the whole side of the house out of copper sheet, that is a very low inductance structure, and you ground the perimeter of that, that would do it. Nobody's got the resources to do that. When you do that kind of grounding that you're describing right now, Alan, you're attacking the symptom. You're not attacking the cause. You, as a physician, know that an awful lot of what some people are doing out of misinformation is taking pharmaceuticals that attack the symptom but not attacking the cause. The cause is
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Where he's got two kinds of symptoms, poor standing wave ratio of the antenna and what he believes is increased electromagnetic interference. There's a high probability that they have a common origin of improper contact somewhere along that transmission line and somewhere along that contact to the antenna. An extremely strong visual inspection of everything involved is the best thing I could recommend. And try to put a Band-Aid on that to attack the symptom with a grounding rod is really going off in the wrong direction, in my opinion. KC2RFN, K2RIW.
And my guess was that he has a bad connection. He had a questionable installer, according to him. The guy ran the coax 75 feet around the house, and the antenna is only right above the shack, probably a length less than 20 feet would have done. That was sort of a red flag to me right off the bat. My guess is the guy did not weatherize. I asked, and the installer 6 years ago did not weatherize the connection at the antenna. He didn't know how the cable was attached to the house. So for all I know, there's a staple going right through the shield into the conductor area or somewhere near it. And I figure there's a lot of a leakage coming out of the shield, and it's been getting worse over the years. So it started leaking into his daughter's radios. And then it couldn't really go to ground through the system he had. So And I told him, yeah, when it starts getting warm, I get a few people over to his house and help him take down the antenna. The problem for him is he has no idea how to do it, and it's pretty high up on his house. He says about 30 or 40 feet. So he'll have to wait till spring. So some sort of Band-Aid will have to be called for. What about Bob OSR had recommended an MFJ artificial ground. Does that sound like a Band-Aid for now that might be useful?
It is worth a try. Remember I told you that length of wire going to ground, if it's an odd number of quarter wavelengths long, what you think is a ground is a perfect open circuit at that frequency. If the length of wire going to earth ground is an even number of quarter wavelengths, half wavelength, one wavelength, one and a half, so on, then it reflects the short circuit. It is a moderately good ground. The so-called ground tuning system takes your length of wire and electronically, like an antenna tuner, makes it longer or shorter to force it into half-wave resonance or an odd number, a correction, an even number of quarter waves. Even number of quarter waves repeats impedance. An odd number of quarter waves inverts impedance. Short becomes open, open becomes short. That's what invert means. All transmission lines do that. It's one of the very crazy characteristics that for a newbie is very hard to understand. It's the opposite of any reasonable common sense. So these ground tuning systems do that. They force you into an odd friction, even number of quarter waves. It could help, but it's not. It's attacking more the symptom than the cause. And he's still going to have the high VISWR. It's not going to correct his high VISWR of his antenna. It may make some improvement on the TBI. I don't think so. Do come back and let us know, Alan, when you finally find out what's going on with his antenna. Because I guarantee there's some lessons to be learned here. And so, even though it's wintertime, an awful lot of the stuff can be inspected. The fact that there's 75 feet of wire, transmission line, let me drop. The fact that there's 75 feet of transmission line where 25 foot would have done it. Assuming it's a quality line of reasonably low loss, he's losing an extra dB or so. That's not a showstopper. And if it's a very neat layout so that now it's all hidden behind rugs and whatever in the house, and if he's a person who likes the house to be beautiful, I can almost justify that one. But still, even though it's wintertime, an awful lot of that system can be visually inspected. Is that connector on the end of the cable that connects to the transmitter, is it really solid? You can twist it and feel that it's mechanically connected, and you can confirm that maybe with an ohmmeter. And then walk along that as much of that 75 feet of wire as you can, visually inspect it, make sure that the portions that are in a house running along the corner of the wall, between the wall and the floor, that somebody hasn't slid a piece of a furniture over there and dug through it. And until the wire starts climbing very high on the house, you can inspect it. And a really agile guy can walk across the roof with a good ladder and the right kind of safety equipment and walk right up to the chimney if it's mounted to the chimney and really do a good visual inspection. With a good set of binoculars standing on the ground, you'd be amazed what you can see, particularly if those binoculars are connected on a tripod. In my case, I've got an 8-inch diameter Schmidt-Cassegrain grain telescope made by the Celestron company. Even though I've got 100 feet of tower, and I stand 100 feet away from that tower in my driveway, I set up that 8-inch diameter Cassegrain grain telescope on a tripod on the driveway, and I look up at a 45-degree angle. Let me drop.
Give me an answer, then, Dick.
And I look up at the top of my antenna, and I put on the eyepiece, the right eyepiece, at that on that telescope. Even though the slant range between me and the top of that tower is 150 feet, when I've got the right eyepiece on that 8-inch diameter telescope, I can count the threads on a quarter 20 bolt. I can tell you how many threads are above the nut on that bolt at the top of the tower. I can do that kind of inspecting. And there are times that have saved me a hell of a lot of labor of climbing the tower for false reasons or making sure I've got the right tools before I go. So even though it's wintertime, you guys have got the technology to do a hell of a lot of inspection of that antenna now. And even though it's wintertime, occasionally you get an Indian summer day where you can do all kinds of good work. So how would you solve this one, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Actually, I'm going to give him the answer. Alan, did you say that it is working fairly well on 17 meters? Was that correct? Over.
Correct.
Okay, there you are, Dick. That counterpoise, so-called, is good for 17 meters. And as you say, to put the bandage right now, if you can't get at the antenna, and I'll tell you, it's most likely, good possibility, it's not the antenna. It is the feed line has gotten water into it. It wasn't properly set up with the proper prevention of water getting into the jacket. I've seen that a number of times. Corrosion, severe corrosion, when you start cutting open the coax cable. Now, the artificial ground, as Alan had just said, will be a bandage. It will make him most likely possible to do better than he is right now. But I'll bet that possibility you won't see much of the antenna, but a good possibility is the feed line, Dick, over.
Yeah, you got a good point there. Many of these feed lines, when water gets down, will start corroding and the braid can turn into powder. And you get all kinds of crazy effects when that happens. It's not easy to visually inspect that one. There are ways that water can crawl down a cable and create damage a couple of feet down the cable, and the outside jacket might still look pretty good. A person like Mel, taking that piece of cable in his hand and twisting it, bending it back and forth, he will recognize the characteristic sound of the braid that is being powdered inside the cable because it was corroded with water. He would recognize that sound. I don't think we can easily teach you how to do that, if you know what I mean, without his kind of experience. A time domain reflectometer would give you some strong clues. And you got to be careful how you use a TDR. TDR is very good at telling you the integrity of everything between the transmitter and the antenna. Every one of your connectors, a good TDR will let you walk through every connector and see the slight perturbation because the center conductor changes diameter as it goes through the connector. A real good TDR will let you walk through the cable an eighth of an inch at a time and see all of this stuff. But the TDR only tells you what the transmission line does. The antenna itself to a TDR is almost always a perfect short circuit, even though it's properly tuned at your favorite frequency and is giving you a 1.2 visuar. The TDR is putting an extremely brief pulse that gives you all the frequencies in the world, and 99% of those frequencies the antenna is not tuned to. So to a TDR, you can inspect the antenna with a TDR, but everything up to it, including the connector right at the antenna. So I would go for binoculars, visual inspection, telescope if you could get it, wait for a warm day, climb the roof, but he's going to find something that's physically wrong. I give you an 80% chance on that one, Alan. KC2R,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
KC2RFN, K2RIW.
Okay, I agree that it's probably going to be a combination of all that. But Mel, you had said 17, it was 17 meters as if it were an aha for you. Was there something significant about it being 17 meters?
When you said that it was working on 17 meters, that means that counterpoise is effective because it is just the right length to get him onto 17 meters. In other words, you asked about an artificial ground. And I say in this case, yes, the artificial ground is going to help him. Put a bandage on the wound. Because you're just telling me now, because that's why I asked you. It is working on one band, 17 meters. Now that counterpoise, for whatever it's worth, is enough to suffice 17 meters, Alan, over.
Okay, now I understand. So putting in this artificial ground will act as a counter-tuner, in a sense.
Exactly what it is, and it will fix a number of these problems. But the original problem, I'm not going to say now that it's going to give them a terrific, on the other band, give them a great radiator, because the problem is basically there, and it's not going to fix that problem. That still exists. You're just, like I say, putting a temporary fix on that situation. Now, as far as using a TDR, as Dick says, now I have one I use, I said, it's a graphic display, and it'll tell me not only the length of the cable, it'll tell me how it's terminated. In other words, like Dick just said, it basically shows you that the antenna at the end of the cable is short. But what kind? In other words, it may show with a TDR that the cable is so many feet long but not terminating at an antenna, that it's somewhere broken maybe to be inches before the antenna. And the cable, as Dick says, many times improper way of preparing the cable or insulating the cable at the antenna permits water to get into the jacket, and boy, you should see. It, as like Dick says, turns the shield the powder, Alan, over.
Are these TDR devices expensive and available for amateurs?
Good question. How deep you want to get into that, really want to do it. It's not a popular instrument with amateur radio. To some extent, you can buy a poor man's TDR. MFJ makes one, that antenna analyzer, I believe, does do something to that effect. It is not a sophisticated instrument like I have. That is about four times just the TDR. It's about three or four times the price of just MFJ, you know, analyzer. Just that one instrument alone, Alan, over.
I've got a suggestion here.
I'll look into that. Maybe Wesley will buy it if it's very expensive. N2XJN, he's buying a lot of expensive stuff. Maybe he could buy it and I could borrow it. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, be careful. You say those kind of words to Wesley, you're going to be spending some of the money that's in his and John's pocket. Go easy with those words. You're a member of a fairly sophisticated club called Limark. And although it's not a popular instrument because of the amount of analysis of the hundreds of antennas that we own as club members, the club members own hundreds of antennas, I should reword that, and as such, an instrument that can be as effective as a TDR. It's about as good as Andy's service monitor. Lots and lots of use. So maybe if somebody at a meeting makes a suggestion that the technical committee should consider the purchase of a common time domain reflectometer, and that it can be shared among club members at field day sites and at their homes and whatever, I think it would pay for itself in a short period of time. Over to you, Alan.
I think it must be really expensive. Okay. This seems to help make up for a lot of sense. A lot easier to inspect the line by just putting it into a piece of equipment and getting a graphical readout. And also gives you peace of mind when you set up your own antennas. I've already got five lines traveling across my property, and I did half the connectors myself, and I don't trust them. And it would be nice to see if I'm running into a problem, is it possibly because of the connector or some other problem along the line? So it seems like it's a tool that's useful to own if you're doing a lot of antenna experimentation. If not, yeah, maybe someone's got one I can borrow, or Limark might actually buy one. That would be nice. Well, like I said, maybe John and Wesley will buy it.
With 5 minutes of use on a TDR, you'd be able to look at the integrity of all of your five lines, and it would give you a real warm and fuzzy feeling. And before I turn it over to John, let me tell you something else. In the early days of television, 1947-48, a Philco 10-inch set or an RCA 630 set, around $550, $575. In today's money, that's probably around $5,000. That's what a television set was then. Nowadays, you can buy a portable color liquid crystal set, in some cases for numbers like, you know, $85, so to speak. The prices have come way down. Time domain reflectometer made by Tektronix or Hewlett Packard in the very beginning, an extremely expensive instrument. There are ways of having a simple scanning oscillator that measures amplitude and phase of reflected signal as you sweep across the band that can give you a computer-generated TDR function. So it's only a matter of time, in my opinion, when somebody's going to come out with an amateur-like TDR for a much, much smaller price. You go out and buy a state-of-the-art TDR from Tektronix today, and you can easily drop $30,000. On the used market, they almost don't exist. On flea markets, they don't exist because people don't know what the hell they are. But once you've used one of those radars in a cable, as it's sometimes called, you say, how in the world have I lived without this?